Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, hello. Welcome back.
Hello. I know we haven't been away from the listener's point of view because we banked up a couple of episodes. Oh, yeah. But yes, it was half term. I went away. Does this mean you didn't have front row seats for the vote of no confidence?
No, I was back for that.
How was that from your point of view?
I just saw lots of Conservative MPs sort of in huddles, really. But it was slightly like... When I ran into them, you had to be sort of slightly careful. You don't really want to say to somebody how you vote. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of slightly too intrusive.
Here's what is fascinating to me about this vote of no confidence. If you just forget for a moment that it's Boris Johnson and all the baggage you bring to that, what do you think it feels like then being in the House of Commons, knowing that all these people sitting behind you on your own side want you out of a job?
Not great.
They're looking in your eyes and you're thinking... Are you one of them?
Not great.
Are you one of the ones?
Not great, I would say. Well, not great.
When I had a job, I'm sure more than a third of the people I worked with, my colleagues thought, oh, he shouldn't be in this job.
But you wouldn't have wanted them to have a vote.
For sure, yeah.
You wouldn't have wanted them to have a vote. No, that is
what does that do to you psychologically?
Yeah, good question.
Because I remember when I interviewed you in 2015...
Oh, yeah, I knew it would get to me, yeah.
but there had been, over the course of your leadership, these times where people had sort of briefed against you or there were rumours of an insurrection. So I was saying to you, how do you get out of bed on a day like that? You're not in the fetal position. You're not weeping into your wife's lap. And you were saying, no, it doesn't bother me, I'm fine. But you couldn't have been, you weren't being honest, right? You were in election mode.
I think there is a sort of, I think, of course, it's not true to say it doesn't bother you, but I think there is something about being in that position that you just have a very thick armor. I think you develop a very thick armor. Like I do remember there when there was a sort of rumors of a putsch against me, you know, I actually never thought it was real and it wasn't really real, but you're more focused on how you put out the fire, not, oh God, there's a fire, I think. And I suspect that's true of Johnson.
But once the fire is out, how do you sit across a desk from somebody in a meeting who you know was ready to stick that knife in?
I don't think I had quite that experience. I think it's obviously much more serious for him because 41% of his MPs said they wanted him out of the job. Yeah, you're right. That is a very graphic thing. Well, look, William Hague said that he would have gone in such circumstances.
It's funny the gymnastics, the mental gymnastics people are capable of.
No, completely right. Now, talking of confidence, How was your holiday and your Speedos?
Let me tell you something. I am a complete convert to the Speedo. Oh. Very comfortable. I feel they gave me extra speed in the water.
What's your favourite swimming stroke?
A slow breaststroke.
Doggy paddle.
A doggy paddle is just a bit too frantic for me.
You don't do the breaststroke head in the water.
No, I barely stay afloat. One of my feet goes errant and splashes a lot. But yeah, the Speedos went down very well, I think. Perhaps they've injected a new je ne sais quoi, as they say in France, into my marriage. I think my wife was quite taken with them.
Oh, my goodness.
I know people say Speedos leave nothing to the imagination, but I don't think anybody is imagining me in that way and hasn't for decades. So I think it's fine. Would you wear them in that pond?
Well, I don't know.
But are you wearing big baggy Bermuda shorts? What are you wearing in that pond?
Well, generally, I'm wearing neoprene.
So these are already streamlined and figure-hugging?
Not that hugging, no.
I'm going to make a suggestion. You're not going to like it at first. Your instant reaction is going to be no, but I just want you to consider it.
Yeah.
Would you think about doing a fashion parade where we model our swimwear on stage at King's Place in London on the 17th of July?
No.
What if between now and then we managed to design and manufacture our own range of swimwear? We could sell it on a merch stall.
Nope.
What about our own range of Veruca socks?
Nope.
I just thought it'd be a tantalising prospect for anybody who's on the fence about buying tickets.
Well, we do want people to come, don't we?
Yeah, it's going to be good. I'm really looking forward to it.
And do you want to remind people when it is?
17th of July, it's Sunday afternoon, and it's at King's Place in London, which is just behind King's Cross. And what is it? No, it's more than 2 years since we last stood on a stage together. It's going to be a wonderful moment.
Treading the boards.
Yes.
Should we talk about what we're going to talk about?
Yes. So this week we are revisiting a subject that we first covered on episode 11 of the podcast, way back in December of 2017. Now, I went back and checked. You had just been to Sweden. And the head of the Olaf Palme Institute had given you a gift. Can you remember what it was?
No. A sauna.
Oh, Ed, what if the head of the Olaf Palme Institute is listening to this? They're going to feel very slighted.
Go on. What was it?
It was a little wind-up music box that played the Internationale.
Oh. You're right. I remember.
Have you not got it to hand on one of those shelves behind you? It was also, this is even better, it was the week of your trampoline mishap.
Oh, goodness me. That's a video that's not going to be ever seen the light of day.
And the detail I'd forgotten about that incident is you squashed a child.
No, I did not squash a child. I added for comic amusement that I had bounced around and a child had sort of fallen over, but it was...
Exaggerated for comic effect.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, I need to see the video.
I think we need to move on to the subject that we're talking about this
Yes.
week.
So anyway, that was when we first covered the ultra-wealthy and getting them to chip in a bit more. Now, last month, a group of millionaires went to Davos and they actually asked governments to tax them more. And we're going to be speaking to one of the members of this group of millionaires, patriotic millionaires. The last time round, it was just an American organisation. Now there is a British sister chapter, branch, I don't know what you would call it. So we have Gemma McGough, and we're going to ask her about why she wants to pay more tax, what it could mean for society, if other rich people followed suit. And we're also going to be chatting to Steph Brobby from the Good Ancestor Movement and Derek Bardawell from 10 Years Time, which connects wealthy individuals with causes in quite an interesting way. And we're going to be hearing how some of the ultra wealthy are in fact trying to address worsening inequality. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Well, on Monday there was a tube strike, and so I decided to ride my bike into work. Anyway, I've discovered something about riding my bicycle which you will not surprise you, which is there's more chance of people saying nice things to you, because when you're in a car, people aren't going to stop me. So I was stopping to adjust my helmet, and a very nice man called Angus Gibson drove past me, I think in a minicab, in an Uber, and then stopped 100 yards up ahead and rushed back to come and have a selfie with me. So I'd like to thank you for having paid Angus Gibson to follow me on my route home from work and get out of the car and get a selfie with me. And I just can't believe, you know, how well organized the those were complicated logistics. So
yes, yeah,
you know,
we had people on every street corner monitoring progress. Yeah.
Thank you. So you had a sort of helicopter, like GPS. Yeah. So thank you for having organized
the eye in the sky. Oh God, I'm just listening to you though, and I'm thinking about you realizing that being on a bicycle is going to make it more likely that people will ask you for selfies. And all the good that has been done by encouraging people to cycle more and putting in cycle lanes, you're going to undo it. You're going to be creating bottlenecks everywhere you go out cycling around looking for people to have the photo taken with you.
That is true. That is true.
If you see him, make sure you ask for a selfie.
Definitely. What's your reason to be cheerful?
Borgen is back.
Ah, yes.
Now, just for any Danes listening, I know it's not pronounced Borgen. That's the anglicised version. But I really enjoyed it the first time around. I'm so pleased to see it back. Do you have to avoid it because it's too triggering for you?
Well, it's a little bit busman's holiday because it's all about climate and oil and, you know, I don't know. I'm sort of in two minds about it. We are a bit short of a box set, so whatever you call them these days.
I'll tell you what somebody was telling me was good yesterday and I haven't seen it. The Stephen Merchant thing. I think it's called The Outlaws.
Oh, what's that about?
It's a drama. It's BBC, but I think it's light and funny in the same way that things like Barry or Better Call Saul can be.
We definitely want light.
Here we go. Seven lawbreakers from very different backgrounds embark on their community payback sentences, which involve renovating a derelict building in Bristol.
Sounds a little bit too much like Close to Home for Justine. You see, the problem is it's finding things that are neither about the law and justice or politics.
Yes.
Do you see what I mean?
I think the two of you should try a little something called Love Island.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So to start our conversation, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by Gemma McGough from Patriotic Millionaires UK. Gemma, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
We spoke to Karen Stewart from the American Patriotic Millionaires a few years back, and the UK version has sprung up since then, and you're one of the founding members. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about your own background and how you came to be part of this movement.
I made my wealth running a profitable business and then selling it and investing some of the proceeds in the stock market. I became involved with the Patriotic Millionaires. I signed a petition by Millionaires for Humanity calling on the government to raise taxes on the wealthy to help cope with the costs of the pandemic. I did so because I could see straight away during the pandemic that you're surrounded by news stories about economic chaos and the people struggling to cope and the soaring use of food banks. And yet I could see my own stock market portfolio was going up. And it seems like, you know, the wealthy can afford to pay more tax and the country obviously needs more tax revenue in order to resolve the climate crisis, the inequality crisis.
And it's so interesting to hear this from your perspective, because so often there's these accusations of class war and envy and all that stuff. And you, as somebody who has the money in the bank or on the balance sheet, and you're saying it wouldn't affect my life materially if I paid a bit more tax.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, there's a lot of notion of like, oh, the rich will just flee if you increase taxes. But I don't really think that's the case. It's not that easy to just pack up your whole life and move to the Cayman Islands or wherever, or Monaco. I mean, how many people actually want to do that, really, when all of your friends and your family and your business interests are here in a stable democracy? I think it's unrealistic to think that everyone would just leave.
You described how you came to being wealthy. You're not from money. Do you think that makes a difference if their story is like yours? Is that, in your experience, the person it's much easier to make the case to?
Yeah, I do think a higher percentage of us made our own money and didn't come from money in the first place. So you've got more of a perspective of seeing both sides of the situation. Although some of our group are inheritees, and so it's... It's not always the case. A lot of people don't like change. And if you've got money, you know, it gives you an enormous amount of protection. I suppose the notion of paying more tax and so on, losing that money is unsettling. I don't share that view myself. I've spoken to a couple of people that were very wealthy, and to try and encourage them to join the cause, and really received a very patronising response.
That was the next question I was going to ask you. What's the reaction of people been? What was the patronising response you received?
Just that, you know, it's very naive to think that you'll ever gather any momentum on that because everyone is really just out for themselves. I had one person that I spoke to that actually expressed some interest and have since sent some information and so on. But generally, it's an uphill battle.
And have you had the opposite reaction from other people being positive about it?
Yeah, by and large, the view of the group from the general public is very positive. Every time we run any things in the press, I get lots of people connecting on LinkedIn to praise the, you know, work of the group and, you know, to say, you know, how inspiring it is. And lots of business people actually that aren't there yet, but think they say, if I ever did, then I would definitely hold the same view as you. And people that are aspiring to be wealthy actually don't necessarily think that paying more tax is going to put them off for that goal.
And the group made headlines recently by, I believe, signing a letter, I think 150 people from around the world, connected to the World Economic Forum in Davos. What were you calling for?
Wealth taxes.
And this is wealth as opposed to income.
Yeah, that's the big focus, is to raise tax on wealth, not work. Where we see any negative feelings about the notion of wealth taxes is where people think, okay, it's going to impact me because as soon as I make any money, I'm going to be paying a higher rate of tax. And that's really not the case. Most people don't realise that you're paying a lower rate of tax on, you know, capital gains tax is lower than income tax and so on. And so, and actually, there is a lot of headlines now on how billionaires are not paying any tax at all, or like such low rates because they're not earning any, you know, income in the conventional manner. We're trying to make it clear that what we're calling on is taxes that really only affect the super rich. I think it's 3.3 million or more on an individual basis in the UK would be affected. So it's really, really like very wealthy people.
One of the things Patriotic Millionaires talks about is the link between a just tax system like the one you're describing and rebuilding trust in government. Can you just talk to us about that idea? Explain the connection between those two things to us.
There is a notion that money is a corrupting factor in politics. The very wealthy that are now, you know, opted out of the social contract are using their money to buy privilege in government. And so with measures to reduce inequality, to revise the tax system to make things a bit fairer, then hopefully we'd reach the point where the very wealthy are, you know, back part of the system. I think actually at the point that you no longer rely on the social contract, that's the point at which you are too wealthy, when you no longer rely on a functioning society because you live completely outside of it, then we've got a real problem on our hands. You're never going to have a completely even society. You need to have like a competition and the ability for people to raise themselves up. But we also need limits to make sure, okay, well, you've done really well, but now, you know, the current system means that wealth continues to concentrate and you need to have some measures in place to stop that happening. Otherwise, as we're seeing now, inequality gets worse and worse and worse, and money's concentrating in the hands of the few.
You said that there's public support. What do you think the impact of the group has been? What's the sort of theory behind the group?
The theory behind the group is that it's very easy for poor people to say tax the rich, and for the right wing to say, well, if you tax the rich, you know, they'll all leave and so on. And so for the rich to actually be saying, yes, tax us, it, you know, acts as a counterweight to that argument.
Yeah.
And helps people to see, okay, well, not everyone among the rich thinks that increased tax would be a disaster. We don't really expect any positive outcome from this government, but we hope that we're laying the foundations for the future for improvements in the next government and so on.
And the name is interesting, isn't it? Patriotic Millionaires. And obviously that's come from the US.
Yeah, it's a horrible name and the US hate it as well.
Oh, really? Oh, right.
It's the most divisive thing. Apparently they've argued about it for years, but they've always settled on it because it's so divisive. And in the UK, we tried two other names and we couldn't really agree on anything that worked. And it's like, well, you know, the US name is well known at least. So although actually it's even less relevant here because we don't use the term patriotic.
If you don't know what it is, it could sound like a sinister cabal of millionaires campaigning for nationalism or something.
The idea is that, you know, in order to be patriotic, you want the best for your country. And actually raising taxes from wealth is the right thing to do. It's the patriotic thing to do. It's how you protect your democracy, how you do the best for your country. So, yeah, it's relevant.
And just to play devil's advocate, is there any risk that you end up looking like the thing you're actively campaigning against? So, like, money isn't just money, it's power. And rich people typically get disproportionate access to be able to lobby and influence decision making.
Yeah.
Now, it's difficult with this because obviously it's like a fundamentally admirable, selfless, decent thing that you're asking for. If you didn't have money, you wouldn't ever get to be in a room in Davos or get the ear of the media in the same way.
Yep, absolutely. So we do get accused of virtue signalling. People say, well, you know, there is a function by which you can just pay more tax or just give your money to charity.
But that has to be universal. You know, one or two or 10 or 15 people doing it doesn't scratch the surface, really.
Yeah, that's what I say. We need system level change. The government is going to need more money to invest in transitioning to a green economy, to, you know, invest in recovery from COVID. It seems to me that, you know, more money is needed. And actually, there is more money than there ever has been. We just need to make sure that a bit more of it is cut off of the very wealthy and channeled back in to benefit everybody else.
And can I ask you a more personal question, which is, you were not coming on to podcasts like ours and doing interviews, I assume, before you did this.
No.
How has it been for you becoming involved in this and being more of a public figure on these issues?
I found it quite interesting learning how the media system works. I mean, I've worked in international business since I was 16, but I've never done anything with being in the public eyes.
Yeah.
From a personal development perspective, it's been really interesting. And I feel like it's an opportunity to use my voice to make a change rather than just, I mean, you know, I do give money to charity and volunteer time and so on, but this is something completely different. I feel like having positive views on this sort of thing can, you know, maybe one day it'll make a difference.
And just to finish, how do you stay optimistic about where this goes in the future?
Well, I think that people are ultimately good and that there are enough of us, there will eventually be enough social pressure for a systemic level change. And I think that the climate crisis will force changes eventually.
Well, look, Gemma McGough, it is incredibly inspiring to hear you. We really congratulate you on your advocacy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
To carry on the conversation, I'm delighted to say that we're joined now by Stephanie Brobby, who is founder and CEO of the Good Ancestor Movement. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In a nutshell, I think you're on a mission to persuade wealthy individuals to become good ancestors. Tell us what that means.
I suppose why I named the organisation the Good Ancestor Movement was really a result of working with and alongside lots of philanthropists and seeing that they were really keen to leave their mark on the world and really preoccupied by the concept of legacy, but realised that actually, isn't it future generations that should determine our legacy in actual fact? And so I'm on a mission really to support people to shift their thinking, people that really want to use their resources to transform the world and to fix some of our most challenging problems. I'm not really in the business of persuading people. I've made a really strategic choice to focus on the kind of early adopters and innovators of this movement, of people that are pushing back against prevailing narratives around excessive wealth accumulation and tax minimization, and actually using wealth to create new economic systems that serve both people and planet.
Can I ask you about what your personal journey is with this? I sometimes wonder if people find themselves in high finance or private wealth like you did. I'm guessing in your 20s, you would have been really focused and hardworking to get there. Was there some kind of like road to Damascus moment where you think, oh, this feels icky to me? Or were the values that you grew up with a thing that you were carrying with you? How did this all become important to you?
Thank you for asking that. It's, you know, this has been a huge part of my personal journey. So I just, by way of background, my parents came here in the 80s. They're from Ghana originally, and they migrated here. I was born here along with my siblings into a working class family, grew up on a council estate in West London, you know, had a terrific state school experience, loved my teachers. Parents taught me about the importance of community. And, you know, my mum was the sort of mum that booted me down to a soup kitchen when I was about eight to help me recognise that actually, yes, we were struggling, but there were people that were, you know, a heck of a lot worse off than we were. And that stayed with me. And I originally wanted to become a human rights lawyer. I studied law and I thought, I'm not sure about all this, and thought I'd become a civil servant. But as it turns out, I was offered a training contract at a firm in the city and bizarrely ended up qualifying into private wealth, private client law, which, you know, I had no proximity to wealth apart from when I moved from a council estate onto a nice street. But I was captivated by the human element. I just developed really great relationships with clients. It was academically and intellectually stimulating. I was just very focused on building up a level of economic stability for myself, having come from economic precarity. And, you know, thought, great. I joined a philanthropic community. I sat on a couple of boards of nonprofits. I thought I kind of remained connected to my roots in a way. New Year's Eve in 2019, I was at a party and a friend of mine walked in and she said two things during our conversation that changed my life. The first was that, according to Dr. Nicholas Nassim Taleb, who's a Lebanese mathematician, the three most harmful addictions in life are heroin, carbohydrates, and a monthly paycheck. And I thought, oh my goodness, am I addicted to my paycheck? Is that what's keeping me in my job?
Yeah.
And the second thing she said was that there were more food banks than McDonald's in the UK. And I always tell that to everyone because I was absolutely horrified that we live in the fifth most advanced economy in the whole world, and yet we have more food banks than the most popular fast food chain. So that was my road to Damascus moment. I thought, I don't want to be part of a system where I'm essentially helping people to concentrate wealth and also depriving governments of their ability to raise revenue through tax efficiency advice and tax minimization advice. So that was my journey. Really, I've come full circle with my pursuit of justice and the genesis of my desire to go into the law. And I'm now in this economic justice arena, which wasn't expected.
And it's a very specific moment in time for this, because over the next few years, there's going to be this big transfer of wealth across generations. Could you just explain why that is?
There are lots of different figures floating about, but it's something around $68 trillion US that's supposed to be changing hands between baby boomers and millennials over the next couple of decades. And that's because baby boomers are a generation that have accumulated a lot of wealth through political and economic circumstances over the last few decades. Millennials are a generation that have been more exposed to what's been going on in the world and our problems and challenges, and so therefore seem to be more inclined to want to use all their resources and their influence and their networks towards social transformation. And so there's this huge opportunity at the moment, particularly against the backdrop of the existential problems that we're facing with climate change and environmental degradation, but also global inequality. And so there's this real energy and a momentum that we're all harnessing at this time to redeploy capital into places that are going to serve our collective prosperity.
Talk to us about the process by which somebody comes to you.
Why don't you role play it, Ed? Why don't you pretend to be like Donald Duck's rich uncle or something, or some eccentric billionaire? You've got an appointment with Steph.
I think you might be better at that, Jeff.
Okay, so Ed comes in, Steph, and he's wearing his top hat and he's got a cape. And he says, I've been very fortunate in my life. I've heard about what you do at the Good Ancestor Movement. What happens next?
They'd probably be coming in on a bike and definitely not in a top hat, judging by our client base so far.
But this is very Ed. He's recently taken to cycling.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. And probably, you know, come from a bit of wild swimming in the morning, you know. So
I mean, you're describing the man here. Apart from the net worth, you have him exactly right.
Yeah. Well, I think the starting point, obviously, we're very focused on building relationships with our clients and getting to know them and their drivers. I have to say, they tend to come to us already with some kind of strong position around social justice or particularly the environment and climate change. But to get everybody on the same page, our main point of engagement at first is educational. I believe that in order to understand some of our most complex challenges, we've got to interrogate systems. To my mind, if you really want to transform the world and you've got a lot of resources, a lot of wealth and influence in the world, the natural starting point is to look at the economy. We run an educational program called Reimagining Wealth, and we invite kind of progressive voices and ideas into that learning experience. We've had Kate Raworth, we've had Aaron Advani, Miatta Fambulla, whole range of brilliant thinkers, political scientists, even a public philosopher coming in and bringing ideas around the need for a balanced economy, the role of taxation, the critical role of progressive tax reform, narratives around inequality and poverty and so on. That piece is really critical in shaping a narrative or theory around the kind of the lens through which they see the world and the world's problems and what's causing those problems. And that then informs the kind of their view on what they ought to do, their practices around wealth and tax in order to build the world that they want to see for future generations.
What's the sort of suite of things that you're hoping they might do at the end of all this?
Yeah, so once their educational gap has been filled, we tend to support them to develop what we call regenerative practices around wealth and tax. And that, first of all, involves looking at their wealth, what they have, what they might have come into in the future, looking at their values. And we've helped them to identify where those values are at risk of being breached or where they're already being breached in the context of their wealth and their tax. So it could be that actually they do believe in a fair society and they do believe that we should invest heavily in public services, and they're actually involved in tax avoidance or tax efficiency, as advisors like me previously would have said. Or perhaps they really care about the environment, they care about people earning a decent wage, and they're actually invested in a ton of really extractive industries and companies, often those that are listed on the stock market. Ultimately, a lot of what we're doing is really supporting them to think through how can they use their wealth to create and build new systems that will serve a new economy. And so that could be helping them to think through where they might start to divest from mainstream investment and start investing in communities or grassroots efforts, investing in leaders. And it has really catalyzed a lot of action among people to start taking control of their wealth insofar as is possible, and redefining their relationship with their advisors and the advisory system, which, you know, is part of the broader economy and therefore seeks to reinforce the prevailing narratives around excessive wealth accumulation and tax minimization.
And on that, you know, if you dig into why there is so much wealth in European countries, in Western economies, you don't have to dig very far until you hit history of colonialism. Is there an aspect to this which it's elevating future generations in a way that past generations were oppressed?
Yeah, absolutely. This work has to be intergenerational. It has to be international. I do this work because I'm pursuing collective liberation. And of course, that sounds a bit woo-woo to people, but really, we can't individually be free until we're all free. And so this is a work of repair and reparation and restitution. So whether you have direct links to slavery and colonialism or whether we're in a part of the world which has benefited greatly from oppressing other nations through extraction, through dispossession and violence and genocide, it's a much deeper work than just looking at supporting people with transferring wealth and redistributing wealth. It's about collective liberation and the work of restoration of both the planet and our societies.
I think what struck me about our guests is that in many ways you're working with wealthy people, but you're trying to get to an understanding and you take a perspective that is about structural solutions, like on tax, rather than simply individualistic solutions. How has this experience, Stephanie, made you think about the sort of balance between philanthropic solutions to the problems we face and the more structural solutions? And what perspective does the organisation have on that?
I suppose all the work that we're doing is trying to work towards a world where we no longer need philanthropy. The influential wealth holder is really to resource the new structures and systems that we're going to need to see us into a sustainable and prosperous and more distributive economy. So that's the balance. But in the intervening period, we recognise that philanthropy is really a tool that can be used to resource the solutions that we need in the future to redesign our structures and systems to ensure that everybody thrives.
We have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is like a utopia where we get to enact all the ideas that we've heard about. Is this something that exists outside of what government can do? Government can increase tax rates and introduce wealth tax, but the kind of shifting of attitudes that you're talking about amongst high net worth individuals, is there something that could be supported in that by government?
The phrase that comes to my mind is this idea, which summarises what our clients and community members are doing or what they're operating in, which is this idea of private sufficiency and public luxury. That's all about investing in public life and, you know, making public life a beautiful, luxurious place for everyone and bringing in different voices and different parts of the community and nature. And really, ultimately, it's all about connection and ensuring that that connection is really well resourced.
Well, look, Stephanie Brobby, it's been great to speak to you. You're founder and CEO of the Good Ancestor Movement. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With us now is Derek Bardawell, who is the chief executive of 10 Years Time. Hello, Derek.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to meet you.
Thanks for joining us. Now, 10 Years Time's Twitter bio says that you are helping funders take big bets on new ideas that could change the world. Now, we are all about world-changing ideas on this podcast. So tell us a bit more about what you do and what the idea behind it is.
Well, we very much take philanthropists and funders through a learning journey, an educational journey of honest reflection, but also radical action to dismantle systems of harm, but also to resource racial and economic justice with care and confidence. We absolutely understand that in order for people to change, this has to be a combination of the head, the hearts and the hands. The people that we work with can meet those that are driving solutions to some of the biggest social issues in this country and abroad to change the way that they give.
To some extent, with very wealthy people, they can be unaware of the way of that accumulation of wealth is impacting other people and society more broadly.
Yeah, that's why it's a learning journey. There will be moments where they are aha moments for people, where there's recognition that some of the things that are happening in this world, that they are partially responsible for it or complicit in some way, shape or form. This is also a journey about unlearning lots of the things that we have been taught through most of our lives, the fact that it's not just individual responsibility, but there are heavy systemic issues, and also just really breaking down some of the history of capitalism, racial capitalism, neoliberalism, really going through some of these really key concepts for people. We live in a society that's very individualistic, that is more around growth and accumulation and preservation and competition. You know, you have organizations like ourselves coming along and saying, well, no, this is actually more about community.
People can be very defensive. If you suggest that the starting line wasn't the same for them than it was for other people, and they can shut down. So it's a way of getting those people to show empathy, I guess.
None of it is easy. We're not sitting there accusing or making judgments of people. There are so many people that we work with where they just don't have the space or they don't have the networks where they can have the type of conversations about these things. And I think what we always say when we work with our clients is that we experience the bumps with them. There's going to be some ouch moments. There's going to be points where you might not like what we're hearing. But there's also going to be some massive points through that journey where you're going to say, oh, wow, I really didn't know that. The other thing that we're always trying to break down is the fact that for many of the people that we will work with, they will often respond to things when it's through the conception of pain or through grief. So they see something on television and then their first response is, oh, we need to do something about it. What we try to do is turn that around and say, well, actually, these communities have some fantastic solutions themselves. They're doing some great things already. Hear about it. Hear what they're doing. This is very different from what you might see on the front page of the newspaper.
And is it also about sort of changing the focus from individual acts, which can be very worthy and important, to organizations that are seeking to change structures,
yeah,
and structures of power?
Yeah, absolutely. We will always advocate for more systemic change. We will always advocate for a rebalancing of power, things that will go to the root cause of social issues. So I give an example that, you know, some of the early conversations that we'll have with clients will start with the notion of giving money, or they're giving, really contributing to something that is going to be quite instant. So it might be, and this is not knocking this, but it might be a food bank. It might be something that is very immediate to the needs of someone that is experiencing some level of disadvantage and harm. As we've gone through the journey with people, we have moved many of our clients on to starting to look at the root causes of poverty and food insecurity as opposed to the services. It might be fantastic to help out 100 people. But if you're talking about a policy change that ends up really benefiting everyone across the country, if you're talking about support in the way that the flow of money goes into a particular area or to a particular group, that's really powerful and that's more sustainable.
We just talked to Gemma McGough from Patriotic Millionaires UK, who are arguing for a fairer tax system. Talk to us about how your work, how you think of it as dovetailing with the work of an organization like that.
So this is going back to how we look at things through a more systemic and structural lens as opposed to an individual lens. And so we might, as a organization working with philanthropists, turn around and say, if you invest your funds in something like looking at tax equity or tax justice or a fairer taxing system, if you are funding the work of, for example, Kate Raworth's Donut Economics, or if you're investing or working with Stephanie Brobby at the Good Ancestor Movement and stuff, for us, you are giving to really being able to change the system that starts to really redress the balance quite fundamentally. What we're finding is that, particularly with next gen wealth holders, that they are thinking more in this way than their parents did in terms of how they feel about their wealth, what they want to do with it, and how they invest it. It means that the way that we contribute is getting those wealth holders to really fund in a different way, but really contribute to funding ideas that really is moving towards a more progressive tax system.
Tell us a bit more about that generational thing. How are they thinking about this? That is different to previous generations.
Well, the people that I speak to, and this is probably within the age bracket of 25 to 35 years of age, generally the ones that I speak to have a greater awareness of racial injustice. They have a greater awareness of climate injustice. And also by doing some of this work, it brings them into conflict with often their parents or other family members and pretty much every wealth holder that sits behind them. This is not what they want to hear, but they are certainly more anxious and aware and thinking about these issues, in my experience.
What I like about this is, at one end of the spectrum, you have an organization like Patriotic Millionaires who want to pay more tax, but their peers laugh in their face when they say that. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got more traditional philanthropy, where you end up with a system where very rich people, with good intentions often, are able to bypass the social contract and the taxation system to fund their pet passions in a way that would be prioritised completely differently to how a government would do it, not by need. And what this model seems to do is shift people from one end to the other.
For us, and I address this in my book, Giving Back, is that actually, philanthropy plays the role of preserving the status quo. So much of philanthropy that we see, and yes, there are tax breaks and everything that's associated with that. But what we find is that there is a deep underinvestment, for example, in organizations that are led by racially minoritized communities. What we see is that a very small percentage of very large charities really accumulate quite a significant amount of the income from charitable trusts and foundations. all of these things, you start to see absolutely replicate some of the disparities that we see in society. But also just to say that philanthropy, given its particularly charitable trusts, its independence, really enables it to be one of the greatest potential catalysts for significant change in terms of really being able to resource really bright ideas, really resource systemic change. At this point, so much of the funding being sticky plaster funding that's trying to cover up the cracks for what the government's not doing, towards really moving towards catalytic resourcing.
Let's end by asking you, is there an example of a favorite 10 years time success story that springs to mind to give our listeners a reason to be cheerful?
Well, there's many reasons to be cheerful. I would say that every single client we've worked with has changed in terms of what their initial conception was. I think that bit that has been the aha moment, which is not just on the personal level, it's the bit around the trust in communities. Some of our clients seeing someone that's experienced a social issue and then funding them and actually saying, okay, we trust them. We trust not only in their experience, but their solutions. That has been one of the more frequent things that have happened with the learning journeys we've gone on.
Well, Derek, it's just been brilliant talking to you and hearing about what you do at 10 Years Time. I find it really inspiring and a way forward. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Ed.
So what did you think?
I think it's one of my favourite conversations in ages. And as is so often the case with this podcast, it was one of the ones where I kind of came into it thinking, philanthropy, it's very nice, but really it's just tinkering around the edges. It has to be about tax policy. And
yeah,
the more the conversations went on, the more I became convinced that fostering empathy in very wealthy people about their own situation and privilege isn't a vanity project or a back rub to get more money out of them.
I mean, I agree it's a really interesting conversation. I think that what all the guests had in common was they're about sort of structural solutions to the problems of inequality.
Yes.
And it's not to sort of downgrade or diminish the importance of giving specifically to make a difference now. So nobody's doing that. But they're saying that on its own, I think, all of them, is not going to move the dial in the way it needs to be moved. And you need big structural solutions. And that requires an understanding of why we have such inequalities in our society. And then it takes you to thinking about the way in which funding can be used. I was reading this conversation between Nick Hanauer, who we've had on this podcast before. He's got a podcast called Pitchfork Economics, and Anand Girandas, I hope I've pronounced the name correctly, who wrote a book called, Winner Take All. And Nick was saying, funding an organization that's campaigning for the minimum wage as a philanthropist is a really good thing to be doing, but it wouldn't be the way you'd normally think about philanthropy. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So philanthropy can fund structural solutions to the problems that the country faces, recognising that philanthropy on its own isn't going to produce the solutions that we need.
I was also very struck by what Steph said about the handover of wealth assets from the boomer generation to the millennial generation. And it reminded me that I haven't yet had a birthday present from you.
God, yeah, I know. It's on my conscience. I'm just trying to find the right one.
Well, I don't know if it's ungracious of me to suggest it, but I think I'd be more suited to the Theragun Elite than the Theragun Pro.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
If you've got thoughts on what you've heard on today's episode, you can find us at cheerfulpodcast.com. We love to hear from you. If you spot me cycling around, wobbling on my bike, we'd also like to hear from you.
We could get a big map and then plot sightings.
Yeah, and if you'd like a selfie, just don't hesitate to ask. Right, talking of self-publicity, this comes from Nigel Geary Andrews, and the subject is, has Jeff acquired a car and has he been mooching around in Purley?
I'm staying tight-lipped until I hear what Nigel has to say.
Hello, Ed and Jeff. I was under the impression that Jeff doesn't drive, so was I. However, does he have a chauffeur and has he visited Purley recently? I saw this car parked at Purley railway station. Maybe it's one of several dotted around the country which kept ready on the off chance Jeff is in the area. Keep up the entertaining podcast. Cheers, Nigel. And here is a BMW car with Jeff Lloyd personalized number plate.
Wow.
Have you got anything to say?
Look at that. It's actually GF110YD.
Oh, is it? The fact that you knew that is very interesting.
Well, I'm staring at a photograph of it.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. That's true.
I've never really seen the appeal of the vanity plate. Have you? Would you have R3D?
R3D.
It kind of looked like Red Ed. Because these things never look exactly what they're supposed to.
No, I haven't really gone down that road, but it's a firm denial, isn't it?
Yeah. What about 5W1MM3R?
Swimmer.
Yes.
Not bad.
All those years of spelling things upside down on a calculator have really paid off for me. It's quite the ability to work these out.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not my car, but...
It's not your car.
It's,
but you wouldn't mind a ride in it.
It's inspired me to take driving lessons. It's given me something to aim for in life.
Yeah.
This comes from Emily Wildbore, who says, "Hi, Ed and Jeff. I know I'm a bit behind, but I've just listened to the episode about urban wildlife, and I wanted to big up Newcastle upon Tyne, not underline. I moved here in July last year from the Midlands, and I've been so pleasantly surprised about the access to green space in a previously very industrial city. There's Ouseburn Valley, which used to be a very industrialised part of the city around the river, and it's had a revival with a barrage installed at the mouth of the river to keep the tide high, encouraging lots of wildlife to return, including otters and kingfishers."
Wow.
She says, "We've also got a moor in the city called the Town Moor and the beautiful Jesmond Dean, which, while you're in the centre of, you'd have no idea you're in a city. There's also an enormous flock of kittiwakes." What is a kittiwake?
I don't know, really. It's a bird of some kind, I would have guessed.
Google image one and describe it for us.
Yeah. Wow.
So what does a kittiwake look like then? You're holding your laptop up to the webcam, but it's
like a seagull.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Well, no, a seagull with grey wings.
I feel that the name kittiwake promises a lot and then delivers something a bit more quotidien.
No, I think they're not bad.
"They return to the Tyne Bridge and neighbouring buildings every year to nest. They're a sight to behold, even if you're not a twitcher. And there's even a group of residents in Heating who are attempting to rewild the back lanes of terraces with pollinator-attracting planters in the hope that it will in turn attract birds and fauna." Well, I think Emily should work for the North East Tourist Board here.
Absolutely. She's done a great job.
And just very quickly, this came in from Chris Glover. And he says, "My son, Peter, swims at the ponds, but so far hasn't investigated the presence of Ed or Dan." How's Dan, by the way?
Not seen him for a few days, actually.
Did you bring him a present back off holiday?
No, the zapper is going to be the Christmas present.
Chris continues, "As an aged non-sleeper, it's my favourite podcast by far. And aww, I think the aubergine dish that Ed mentioned is shakshuka."
I don't think it was. I have made shakshuka.
That's very
before.
Eggy, isn't it, that?
It's egg and tomato. I didn't know there was aubergine in it.
Well, thank you for your email, Chris. And just stick a pin in the idea of Ed's cooking, because
there's more to come.
Send us your ideas or suggest a guest for a future episode. Email reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or tweet at Cheerful Podcast.
Oh ho ho, we're in the outro.
We are, and we dangled a carrot.
Yes, it's taken us 200 and something episodes. It's the best segue from stuff to the outro that we've ever had.
It's Ed's culinary skills, because you sent me a photograph.
Yeah.
You captioned the photograph, "Prize, if you can guess what this is."
Yeah.
And then you added, "It's not feces."
Yeah. I just thought, because you would say...
Well, straight away, I thought, oh, it's fecal matter. This is revolting. Yeah, we've got our boundaries here.
No, I thought you were going to just say something rude.
Well, it looks like, you know when you hear comedians talking about how you don't see white dog poo anymore?
I didn't know you'd had that, but yeah.
It looks like, do you remember Morph had a friend called Chad? Has he melted? Has he been in some kind of terrible accident?
No. See, I want a serious guess.
I think it could be some kind of dip, or it could be some kind of uncooked dough that's about to go into the oven, and it does look like it's perhaps on greaseproof paper. So I think you have made a muffin. That's my guess.
I'm afraid you're wrong, and Rachel is right. Rachel said it was aubergine related, and it is indeed baba ganoush.
Baba ganoush.
I mean, that's pretty impressive, eh?
Did it taste as good as it looks?
I made some aubergine dish. I can't remember what it was. And then I ended up with too many aubergines. So I thought, okay, we can't just keep eating aubergines. I'll turn it into baba ganoush. And I was a bit short of lemon juice. I'd also put too much garlic in, but I thought it was pretty nice.
You're really selling it to us. Too much garlic, not enough lemon juice.
No, as a first go.
Looks like fecal matter.
As a first go, it was creditable, I'd say. I mean, I ate it, which is a good... I wasn't just eating it because I wanted to sort of make myself feel better. I sort of thought it was quite nice.
I think definitely making something that isn't required to hold an aesthetically pleasing form is a good direction to go for you.
I don't think that's right, is it? I mean, surely I want something with an aesthetically pleasing form, because your point
I wonder if you're trying to run before you can walk, though. I wonder if it's a bit beyond you at the moment. So
something
which just looks like a dollop is probably quite good for you.
But then you just sort of say bad things about it when I send you the picture. You either say, why didn't you send me the picture? Or I send you the picture and then you say, you know, something horrible.
Well, it was you that said it's not feces.
No, I know, but I wanted to hedge you off at the pass. That's the point.
I really want to try some of this stuff. Would you consider posting some through my letterbox?
Some baba ganoush.
I'm worried, though, that if this came through my letterbox, I'd think one of my neighbours had a grudge against me.
You just said you wanted to taste something so you could then make that rather lame joke.
I did, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Should we thank our guests?
We should. I really enjoyed talking to everyone this week, as I always do. But
I don't think I've enjoyed talking to you, if I'm honest, the last few minutes. So, you know, I mean, it's good that you enjoyed talking to our guests. So I did too. But just like present company excluded.
It's good to have a third wheel there when things are a little strained between us.
Yeah, exactly.
You're on your best behaviour when there's somebody else.
Exactly.
Yeah, Gemma McGough, Derek Bardowell and Steph Brobby. Emma Corsham is our audio producer. Our content producer is Rachel Barmer, who's supported by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made our idents. Ed Seed composed the music. And our artwork was designed by...
Henry Cole. He's been GF11OYD.
He's been 3DM111118AND.
And these have been...
Reasons to be cheerful.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.